Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. The Syracuse region is dealing with an affordable housing crisis, and the redevelopment of the area under I-81 in the city, along with the new Micron microchip facility in nearby Clay, create both opportunities and new challenges regarding that problem. My guest today is an expert on zoning policy and sees zoning, to borrow from the title of her new book, as one of the keys to properly managing those opportunities. Sarah Bronin is an architect and lawyer, a professor of city and regional planning at Cornell University, and the author of Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. Professor Bronin, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we appreciate you making the time. So let me just start with a really basic question about the book. What made you want to write a book all about zoning when you did?
Because zoning is a hidden power that shapes how we live, how we organize our cities and towns, and actually has huge ripple effects on the national economy, on our society, and I think our happiness. So zoning is something that people may have heard about, but don't necessarily understand that well. And my book attempts to provide a peek into zoning and its consequences.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up on exactly that last point that you made, because I agree with you. When people think of the important decisions and essential investments for a robust and healthy and livable city and the region surrounding it, zoning isn't always the first thing that comes to their mind. So explain a little bit why zoning is as important as you just said.
Zoning tells us where we can build different things in our communities. So we can zone for residential uses. We can zone for commercial uses, for open space, for religious institutions. Zoning through a combination of a text, which is the zoning code, and a map, which maps out a city, again, dictates where everything is located. And zoning is typically done at the local level. It's done by elected officials for the most part, although some places delegate that authority over to a local zoning board. But by and large, it's a political process that happens at the local level that has pretty big consequences on all of us, even if we don't know it.
Mm. And, you know, reading your book, it reads to me like, you know, a really interesting and really nice piece of an extremely long form journalism, because it's, you know, the entire book, but it's also well documented. You're an academic who's been studying this. I guess, I don't know whether you'd be able to answer this or not, but how did you make the topic of zoning so interesting?
It's inherently interesting. I mean, if you think about some of the, you know, local journalism that catches a lot of people's attention, oftentimes it's zoning fights, fights over a stadium, whether that can be located, fights over affordable housing, arguments about open space and whether people are doing their fair share in providing that. Industrial rezonings. I mean, there's so many things going on in zoning right now that, again, you know, you may, as I'm talking, have think to yourself, oh yeah, there was that story in the paper. So I think it's inherently interesting because it speaks to how we want to live and people have opinions about that. And so when they have the opportunity to weigh in, when something gets local attention, they do, because zoning helps us to work through, or not, as the case may be, these questions about how we want to live.
Mm. So you start the book with this vignette about Houston, and I understand that's where you grew up. Is Houston the best example of the worst decisions that can be made about zoning?
So for listeners not familiar with Houston's zoning regime, I should just say there isn't one. Houston is the only large American city without zoning. I grew up there, and as I talk about in Key to the City, you know, unbeknownst to me as a young child, was experiencing some of the negative effects of the lack of zoning. And those included living right next to a gas station and a strip mall. And when I went back and visited the El Príncipe Azul nightclub, and even further, just further down the block, a self-storage facility. And these are not the kinds of things that make for a very fulfilling environment for a child. And to me, going back and reflecting back on that experience and thinking, well, what caused this? What makes other communities better? I do think zoning has a positive role to play. Now, that said, the book also covers a lot of bad things that zoning has done.
Yeah, and I wanted to pick up on that. So the cities that have, well, I guess Houston is this one without any, but the cities that have bad zoning policy, as you would see it, is there any kind of shared set of characteristics in those cities, either politically, geographically, anything else that kind of makes them a group?
You know, one of the things that I've done to try to investigate that question is develop this project called the National Zoning Atlas, and it's online at zoningatlas.org. And we've mapped about 5,000 cities, towns, and counties across the country. And, you know, in thinking about your question, how much zoning is the same? How much is it different? While each of these local governments that we've reviewed have different ways of writing their code, of course, they have different maps, they have different types of districts. They might call a single family zone an R1 district in one community or an R40 district in another community. What we see, by and large, are very similar results. And those are that cities tend to be the places that have mixed housing options and mixed uses. Whereas suburban towns and even rural areas tend to have a much more residential focus, a focus on single family housing on large lots that's detached and no other kind of housing. And I actually think that the lack of diversity in housing, the lack of diversity in zoning for a mix of uses is by definition bad zoning. So when you're asking me, you know, how many communities have bad zoning, how common is it? I would say bad zoning is far more common than good zoning right now. And my hope is that by writing this book, people will look at their own zoning codes and consider whether their zoning code is on the good side or maybe can use some improvements.
You're listening to The Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Cornell University City and Regional Planning Professor Sarah Bronin, and she's the author of Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. Well, in what you just described, you've really, as you probably are aware, sort of hit on the central nerve of where a lot of the big debates and discussions are going on in the Syracuse area, and I want to come back to that in a little bit. But given then your And you're certainly not alone in making this argument that there's a value to having different kinds of housing in the same area in terms of income and other kinds of means of diversity. What are some of the best cities and suburbs that have done that? You say that they're the exception rather than the rule, but where are they? If there are a couple of shining examples, and why do you think they've been able to be different?
Well, I think when it comes to a good zoning code, there are a couple of examples not too far from Syracuse. So I chaired the City of Hartford, Connecticut's Planning and Zoning Commission for 7 years, and we rewrote, totally overhauled the zoning code. And I think that's a pretty good example. In Hartford, there's not a huge demand right now for a lot of new development, but as development happens, the zoning code is shaping it in a way that I think is more sustainable. We've made all housing as of right. We've eliminated minimum parking requirements. We've included lots of sustainability provisions into the code. And I felt pretty happy stepping down from that commission, having hopefully worked with neighborhood leaders and our community to try to make a document that would provide the template for future growth. Maybe even closer, or at least conceptually closer, a good zoning code might be found in the nearby city of Buffalo, New York. So they also overhauled their zoning code, created what they called a green code, had many of the same provisions that we had in Hartford. But a city, both like Syracuse and Hartford, Buffalo is a historic city, lots of historic neighborhoods, a post-industrial city, which has manufacturing buildings, large institutional developments that need to be repurposed. And I think the name of the game in zoning is incorporating flexibility. So for any community, a community that really takes a look at its old zoning code, tries to reformulate it for today, is doing better than just letting it sit on the shelf.
One of the things that I've been struck by here, and I'll come back to this a little bit later, but I'll frame it as a general question now, is whether the city and the city government, the city residents and the city government, and then the surrounding towns and the populations there and their local governments, whether they can get on the same page when it comes to thinking about zoning and cooperate with each other, at least be able to talk to each other. Is that something, first of all, that you would see as a problem that is shared around the country? Am I identifying a correct problem? And then secondly, in thinking about actors that might come in and help, is this something that the state government can come in and do something about? Because we've seen some efforts here for the, you know, the governor to get involved, or the state government to get involved.
So that's a great question. And increasingly around the country, we are seeing states becoming more involved in local zoning. Stepping back to provide the legal framework here, it's states that actually have the power to zone. And through what we call zoning enabling acts, really crafted modeled after a 1920s U.S. Department of Commerce State Standard Zoning Enabling Act, all 50 states have delegated their powers to zone to local governments. So it's always been that states have a role in zoning, but right now there's been a lot of movement in states like California, Montana, Vermont, even Connecticut, where I did some work. There's been a movement of states to reshape and not necessarily take back the zoning power, but make sure that local governments are zoning in a way that meets statewide goals. You do see a lot of communities around the country, hands off my zoning, or, you know, local control. But that really, I think, that sort of perspective is inconsistent with the zoning power, which is a state power that, again, by over the last century has been delegated to local governments. But you know, I think that the states are now reasserting themselves to some extent. New York State hasn't really done that. You did see Governor Hochul's proposal last session, you know, and it did raise some controversy. And in fact, one of the reasons why I've prioritized with the National Zoning Atlas our work in New York State is because I think that policymakers could use the help with the data that's provided by the National Zoning Atlas to help them make more informed decisions.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Sarah Bronin. She's an architect, an attorney, and professor of city and regional planning at Cornell University. And she's written a new book. It's titled Key to the City: How Zoning Shapes Our World. So, Sarah, you mentioned about this National Zoning Atlas that you have put together, looking at towns, cities across the country. And I understand that Syracuse is one that has been mapped there. What do you see when you look at your map for Syracuse in terms of the zoning atlas?
So Syracuse, the region of Syracuse is almost fully up on the map. So if your listeners live in the city or in the suburbs, you'll probably find your town on the map. And by the way, it's at zoningatlas.org for anybody who wants to follow along. But if you look at Syracuse as a city, so of course its zoning jurisdiction is limited to city boundaries, you see lots of places where single family homes can be built. We've calculated that about 67% of Syracuse itself allows for single family housing. But you also see lots of land where apartments can be built as of right, meaning without through some onerous public hearing process. 50% of land in Syracuse allows for multifamily housing as of right. This statistic is actually higher than we see in many other similarly sized cities around the country. By contrast, if you look at the suburbs around Syracuse, if you look, for example, at Onondaga County, you see basically no land that's zoned for multifamily housing. If you look next door at, oh gosh, let me see if I can, Salina, that allows for maybe 5-6% of single family housing. So it's a really big difference that we see in the zoning atlas between central cities and their suburbs. And I think that what the zoning atlas does for us is show in very stark form for all the public to see the sort of end result of zoning regulations. And what we've done, by the way, to create these maps is we've read through 890,000 pages of zoning codes, and we tie the information in those codes to these maps. We digitize the zoning maps. And so what a user sees is the standardized way that we've logged it, so they can compare much more easily their town to another town. I encourage your readers to look at it, but I do think it's consistent with other places in the country and that the city is doing more for housing. But Syracuse in particular is doing a not so bad of a job when it comes to permitting multifamily housing.
Very interesting. And yeah, really great that standardization is there so you can compare apples to apples. So let me bring Syracuse into my questions a little bit more specifically. And we have this affordable housing crisis. You've kind of given us a little bit of a glimpse as to where some of it might be coming from, looking at the towns and the suburbs of the city. And there isn't anything approaching universal agreement here, I think, yet on what to do about it. But we've got these two major developments that any future plan about housing has got to account for and deal with. And again, as I said before, I think they bring both opportunities and challenges. The first being the removal of I-81 through the downtown and the redevelopment of the land and its footprint. And the second is this arrival just north of the city in Clay of Micron, which is going to be, as I said before, building this huge chip manufacturing facility. And that's going to generate a lot of high paying jobs. People are excited about that. What should we be thinking about, do you think, here in Syracuse and the area as we plan for those changes? What do we need to avoid, or what do we need to keep sort of front of mind as we're thinking about this stuff, do you think?
So let's start with the first opportunity, because I really do view it as an opportunity, the removal of the highway. As soon as that happens, hopefully the sooner the better, right? Syracuse will have an opportunity to rezone that land for the kind of uses that would knit both sides of the highway back together. Probably the city will be considering mixed uses. So not just residential. I can't imagine, given where I-81 is, that you'd be doing large lot, single family housing, sort of suburban style tract housing there. You're probably going to have multi-story mixed use development. So when you think about that, do you want to require developers to put in big parking garages? Do you want to, so that I would say you don't, but you know, something to consider yourselves. Do you want to have sustainability measures that are included in your zoning? I do address in Key to the City a lot of the ways that a zoning code can actually make better streetscapes, can manage stormwater, can include what you might call environmental infrastructure like trees and grasses, even in urban locations. So I think the city should really review all of the things that zoning can do in trying to figure out how to rezone that newly created opportunity land. You also mentioned Micron. Now, this is a huge development for upstate New York. As a matter of fact, I was in Syracuse at Syracuse University last January to give one of my very first talks about the development of the National Zoning Atlas and the New York Zoning Atlas. And I said, Syracuse, eventually you'll be in the Atlas. And of course, now it is. But this was a conversation that was happening back then. How does the region address the regional needs for this massive new investment, bringing in lots of workers? Now, I think you mentioned Clay. Clay is up in the zoning atlas. 1% of land in Clay allows for multifamily housing. You have the rest, the vast majority of it's really just single family housing. So when you're thinking about the kinds of workers that want to work in high tech and in advanced manufacturing, the kinds of things that Micron is providing opportunities for, you have a lot of people, especially young people, people with families who don't necessarily want to live in a large lot suburban style housing. So how are you going to get people who are to work at Micron, to work in the kinds of developments, to work and then live in developments that they want to live in? I think you got to move beyond Syracuse to think about the ways that you can provide new developments and new housing at the scale and of the type that these new workers are going to demand. It's asking a lot of somebody to, move to a place where they may not have that many housing options. And if, again, you look at the Syracuse region, there's got to be an acceleration of the efforts to rezone the areas outside of Syracuse, and of course, Syracuse, I'm sure, could use some tuning up in its zoning too. But I think the big opportunity for the region is rethinking the rules of the game when it comes to zoning, so that it can support not only the new workers that are coming in through Micron, but also the constellation of other businesses that can support what's happening at Micron. So thinking regionally about zoning is critical in the region, in Syracuse. And I hope that, again, it's not just Syracuse that's providing those housing opportunities. It's the whole region. That's what it's going to take to enable and facilitate this kind of expansion.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. And my guest is Cornell University professor Sarah Bronin. I wanted to pick up exactly on that last point that you were making, because there was another report on zoning that was done here by CNY Fair Housing, and they found the same things that you have been explaining to us. And there really is this issue with the surrounding towns and villages regarding housing density. I've seen it in my own town. I live outside the city, and there was a proposed mixed income housing unit that was being considered down the road. And I watched people who were otherwise pretty liberal in their views discover their inner conservatives when they were opposing the project, and the project was ultimately scrapped. So this report from CNY Fair Housing said that in Onondaga County, on average, 74% of all the residential land only allows for single family homes. And as you've demonstrated, that number is even higher depending on what town you look at. So how do you get the buy-in and the change from these towns when they have staked their reputation and appeal to a large degree on providing something entirely different from what these more favorable zoning regulations, thinking about Micron and, as you say, the whole constellation of activities that could come from that, where that would take you in your thinking? It seems like there's just a mismatch between, you know, what some of these towns sort of advertise as their essence to people moving in, and then the needs that are changing. I don't know how you make that argument. Can you give me a hint?
This is a challenge that we've seen all over the country, and a challenge that, as I noted, is being increasingly addressed by state governments, because that it's hard to break through, I would say, some outdated notions about how a community should be developed. You see, actually, in lots of suburbs and even wealthy towns, people who've lived in those towns for years who want to downsize to senior housing, maybe to a townhouse, they don't have opportunities to downsize within their town. You see young people coming back. They might want to live in their town. I love my parents. I wish they lived with me or near me. But you know, I don't think that lots of young people have opportunities to move into some of the suburbs where they grew up in. And so I think from a, you know, even when you sort of talk about those needs, you sometimes don't get the buy-in because there's fear of change. You know, what will happen if we build townhouses? What will happen even in a 2-3-story apartment building? What could happen? Could there be crime? Could there be burdens on the school system? You hear these things over and over again. If you look at academic research, you know, those issues not only are addressed and not raised, the sort of worst case scenario that many people think might happen with multifamily housing, but in fact, multifamily housing often is net revenue positive for towns. They pay higher rates in terms of taxes. They use fewer services. There's a, you know, think about 10 suburban style, you know, large lot homes being served by a pretty long road if they're 1 acre or 2 acre minimum lot sizes. Think of 10 homes served by one apartment building. The roads, the sidewalks, the upkeep, it's not just a tenth less, it's probably 5% less in terms of, or 5% of the investment in infrastructure and maintenance that the same city would be doing for 10 spread out homes. So, you know, again, even sometimes when you appeal to the logic, you know, the idea that your family needs housing options in your own community, the idea that this is actually more cost effective for a city to permit this kind of development, you may not always break through. And again, that's why you see some states stepping in.
Interesting. We've only got a couple minutes left. I wanted to squeeze in another question if I could. And this may be too much in the weeds. And if it is, I've got a second question I could ask you. But the the city has this new housing strategy that they have published, and they've established a new housing strategy corporation to implement this. And the basic starting point is the city doesn't have the resources to match the scale of the affordability problem, the city itself. And so this strategy makes some difficult decisions and establishes some priorities. And the first thing that it's doing is it's focusing on middle-income neighborhoods, according to the report, because they're less able to secure other state and federal funding. And the emphasis within that, as far as I understand it, is to create financial incentives and investments to get the current owners to reinvest in the homes, and then to sort of bring the level of the whole sector up, these kind of smaller plots that they've divided the city up into. And they're hoping that that will kind of drive out the worst properties and the irresponsible owners and lift everybody up. I'm sure it's much more complicated than I've just described, but in a minute or so, could you share, does that approach for the city of Syracuse make sense to you? Are there any kind of things that concern you based on how I've described it?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know. There's a lot of real estate market dynamics that I'm sure are at play. But I think it raises the point that zoning is not the only thing that needs to happen. So, in some cases, you can change the zoning and nothing will change, because let's say the real estate market doesn't have, doesn't demand that, or won't support that kind of development. In other cases, you might need a little boost to encourage property owners to develop in certain ways. So whether that's the creation of a tax increment finance zone, whether it's straight up grants, whether it's something else, those are things that have to be considered in tandem with zoning. So while zoning isn't the only thing, I think it's pretty important, and I hope folks check out this book to find out more.
Yeah, I think they should. We'll have to leave the conversation there. That was Sarah Bronin. And again, her new book is Key to the City, How Zoning Shapes Our World. And again, she's also founded this National Zoning Atlas, and you can find it again. Where's the link?
Zoningatlas.org.
Fantastic. We'll put that up on our website too. So thank you again for making the time. This is really great.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. Conversations in the Public Interest.
The Campbell Conversations, Conversations in the Public Interest, is hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio. Assistant producer is Jacqueline Witwicky, and the program is edited by Mark Lifonia. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program and hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.